you're a very unusual zoo animal, Inglis. An actual conservative who says climate change is real.
There's a thin on the ground at the moment.
That's right. That's like an albino unicorn or something.
That's right.
One for mum, one for dad, one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be in Australia.
Dead, buried, cremated.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute, and in this episode of Follow the Money, I'm talking about the climate debate with someone a little different. Bob Inglis is a dyed-in-the-wool conservative from South Carolina's Republican heartland, and he backs a revenue-neutral, border-adjustable carbon tax. That's right, you heard me, a conservative Republican who backs climate action. Bob and his wife Marianne have been visiting Australia on a speaking tour for the past 2 weeks as guests of the Australia Institute. We invited Bob Inglis out here because, well, he's got a powerful message about how to act on climate change in a way that aligns with conservative values. And in the current debate, we think that this message is really more important than ever. But as he explains, he didn't always back climate action.
I thought it was nonsense, but that's because I came from a very conservative district, probably the reddest district in the reddest state in America, Greenville-Spartanburg, South Carolina. And so if Al Gore was for it, I was against it. And so Al Gore was for it, and therefore I was against it.
Simple as that.
Yeah, I admit that's a rather ignorant position, but it was a position I took for 6 years in Congress. And then, of course, I was out 6 years doing commercial real estate law again and then ran again in 2004.
And what changed your mind on that? You talked about your son's intervention. What happened there?
It was an intervention. I think that is what I'd call it. My son came to me when I was running again in 2004. He just turned 18. He's voting for the first time. And he said to me, "Dad, I'll vote for you, but you're going to clean up your act on the environment." It's the first of a three-step metamorphosis for me. And, you know, his mother agreed, his four sisters agreed. They could all change the locks on the doors. That's a very important constituency to respond to.
A powerful constituency.
Very important. You got to listen to those folks. Yeah. Second was going to Antarctica with the Science Committee, seeing the evidence in the ice core drillings. In the 5,000 feet of ice, we have an amazing record of the Earth's atmosphere. And in that record, we see stability, followed by an uptick in CO2 levels that coincides with the Industrial Revolution. It's pretty clear in the science that we are causing that impact. So that's what I saw in Antarctica. That's the second step. Third step was another Science Committee trip, Great Barrier Reef, an Aussie climate scientist named Scott Herron showing us coral bleaching or the impacts of it. I could tell we shared a worldview without any words being spoken. I could see him worshiping God in what we were looking at, and I could see his excitement in God's creation. So I knew we shared a worldview. After we had a chance to talk, and he told me about conservation changes he was making in his life in order to love God and love people. He rides his bike to work. He tries to do without air conditioning. He takes the stairs, not the lift. I mean, he does all these things to consciously love people who come after us. And maybe many who come along after us. And I got right inspired by that. I wanted to be like Scott Herron, loving God, loving people. So I went home and introduced the Raise Wages, Cut Carbon Act of 2009. Probably not a good idea to introduce a carbon tax in the midst of the Great Recession, of the global financial crisis, in the reddest district, in the reddest state in the nation. It did not go well for me.
And what happened after that?
Well, there was an election, and it wasn't even close. And another fellow got 71% of the vote, and I got 29% of the vote after 12 years in Congress, which is a rather spectacular faceplant. At that point, a foundation came along and said, "You know, you're a very unusual zoo animal, Inglis, an actual conservative who says climate change is real."
There's a thin on the ground at the moment.
That's right. That's like an albino unicorn or something.
That's right.
We're reproducing. We're getting more and more of us.
Why do you think that conservatives, I guess, as a group in the United States, seem to have such a hard time with climate change? Why has it become so partisan, do you think?
I think it happened because of the global financial crisis, mm-hmm. is where the collapse of support began. You call it the global financial crisis in America. We call it the Great Recession, because it's got close to being a Great Depression.
Yeah.
And so what happened, I think, is people got really startled and frightened by the collapse of yet another institution and the distrust of another institution. And so in that discontent, or in the high tide of that discontent, some people spent some well-timed campaign cash to generate a wave of publicity against climate action. And it came over the seawall and shorted out all the climate change equipment. We've been bailing ever since. You know, the question that should be asked is not, do you believe in climate change? Because that makes it seem like it's an article of faith or something. We think the question that should be asked is, can free enterprise solve climate change? We think that conservative elected officials can answer that question in front of the reddest districts in the reddest state in America and say, yes, sure, free enterprise can solve this. Because we think what we have here is a problem of economics that has an environmental consequence. So it's appropriate I'm talking to you at Follow the Money, right?
Because that's right.
That's what it's all about, is if you just follow the money here and figure out how to fix economics, then the environment will take care of itself on this. In other words, the accountability that will come from a pricing of carbon dioxide, from our perspective as conservatives, in a revenue-neutral way, so there's no growth of government, and in a border-adjustable way, so that we use the power of access to the American market, which so many producers around the world want, especially the Chinese, mm-hmm. if we use that power to say to them, when you bring your goods in, we will apply our tax unless you have one back home of equal amount, in which case your goods come in without any adjustment. Using that market power and making it revenue neutral is consistent with what conservatives believe.
Of course, I had to ask about President Trump. It seems impossible to think that Trump would tackle climate change. Bob, on the other hand, is more hopeful.
It is improbable, but here's what I'd say, Ebony, that potentially with Donald Trump, I can't guarantee this, what I'm about to say, but I think there is a strange possibility that Donald Trump, who has no settled views on anything, might just want to complete the sentence this way. Richard Nixon went to China, Bill Clinton did welfare reform, and Donald Trump did climate change. Mm. Because it sort of fits with The Art of the Deal, his book that he didn't write the book, another guy wrote the book for him. But it fits with the idea that we're going to make a deal.
Yeah.
And the deal is that America is going to act without any international agreement, just act, to price carbon dioxide and say, if you've got the same price at home, fine, bring your goods in, no adjustment, we want trade. But if you don't have that price at home, we're going to collect it on entry into the United States. And then we would use that revenue either to give it back to the people in the form of a dividend or reduce taxes somewhere else. I think that Donald Trump could actually say that at a rally. It would be very America-centric. He could make it bellicose by saying something about how China is going to have to, pay for it or something. I can really see how it could work.
Yeah.
It is a strange thing to think that it could happen that way, but, stranger things have happened.
I'm an atheist, but I've really enjoyed listening to Bob talk about how climate action is an expression of his faith, loving God and loving people, as he would say. And so I asked him why so many other religious conservatives in the United States don't seem to share his approach.
Yeah, I think there's a growing number of especially young Christian believers in America who would agree with what I'm about to say. Their parents and grandparents, not so much. We're clearly called as people of faith to be stewards of God's creation. That's very clear from Scripture. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I think applies here is we got some people right now who must know they're in the wrong spot. In other words, they have staked out a political position that they know isn't supported by data. They talk about sunspots causing climate change. Well, we know that's not accurate. They talk about various really pretty silly theories that the scientific community knows are not, it don't bear up with the facts. Mm. And so when you get yourself out in a bad place or in an argument where you know you got the short end of the stick, typically what most of us do, and I admit to doing it, is I get louder, right?
Yeah.
So the real role of faith there is to allow people to say, listen, I'm sorry, I was wrong. Because if you believe that there's grace available and love that's going to support you in that correction, then you can be corrected. It's when you are stuck in a position where you have no grace, no love, no possibility of forgiveness, that you've got to continue to save face, and you will continue to say things that are embarrassing to your children and grandchildren. It's pretty clear the dad is right.
Yeah.
And so let's be corrected and have the humility of coming around.
Bob also has a wonderful way of explaining why the messages and policies of the climate movement have been so unappealing to conservatives.
It seems to conservatives like the godless scientist. They're not all godless, as evidenced by, as I said earlier, my friend Scott Herron. But the godless scientist got together with the UN bureaucrats with the blue helmets on. They roped in the Wall Street traders, and they came up with this behemoth called the cap and trade, which we conservatives immediately branded cap and tax in America. Later, President Obama came along with the Clean Power Plan because he saw that the cap and trade plan wasn't going to work. And so that was a regulatory response. What all that means is that all that I've just been saying there is completely unattractive to conservatives. Mm. It looks like a bigger government that's going to try to tell me how to live my life, that's going to take my money, that's going to limit my liberty. And that's just really unattractive to conservatives. What we've got to do is turn that language completely around to, here's what it is. It's all about accountability. And don't we as conservatives believe that blessings flow from holding people accountable? It's not just that we are getting ready for Armageddon here and the, you know, we're all going to die tomorrow, you know, some kind of, if you tell me that, denial is a pretty good coping mechanism.
Yeah.
But if you tell me, listen, there's an opportunity here to do this better, and we're gonna have really great outcomes here.
And make money.
Make money. We're going to make money selling these better systems. I mean, what the future is distributed energy with better solar, better batteries, and villages in India that are currently dark at night are going to be lit up at night. Their students are going to be contributing their creativity to the world supply. If we play our cards right, we can sell them those systems, create jobs, make some money by serving our customers. And what this is all about is the pressure from developing economies on developed countries with globalization and automation. That's what's creating the pressure. People are feeling pressure. They're not sure that their children will do better than they did. They're not sure their children will do as well as they've done. And that's a big change for a country like America and perhaps Australia to have that sense. And so it's really challenged us right at the core of who we think we are. Mm-hmm. These people that are forward-thinking, nations that are going to shape the future, that we're realizing the challenge that others are making to our standard of living. And so I tell you, if I thought I had the clear answer to how to deal with globalization, automation, even without presidential hair and with no name ID and no money, I think I could get elected president. Actually, apparently, presidential hair is no longer required.
Well, thank you very much for taking up our invitation to visit us in Australia, and the tour is going great so far.
Well, we're enjoying it tremendously, and we thank the Australia Institute for doing this.
That's been episode 16 of Follow the Money, brought to you by the Australia Institute. You can subscribe on iTunes or find previous episodes on our website at tai.org.au/podcasts. Bob Inglis is the founder and executive director of republicaen.org, a community of conservatives and libertarians advancing free enterprise climate policy. You can follow Bob on Twitter at Bob Inglis, that's I-N-G-L-I-S. and republicen.org at republicen. His address to the National Press Club is available on iView, and I really encourage you to check it out. You can follow me at Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T, or the Twitter handle for the Australia Institute is the Oz Institute with an AUS. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy. Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum composed our title track, and you can find more of his music at pulseandthrum.com. Thanks for listening.